Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 122, Eat Your Words, Saturday, May 28th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. You can also find photographs, show notes, and links to things I talk about on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. Today's episode features the following segments: Sew Forth, Ever Expanding Skill Set, Off the Shelf, and I will conclude with a very brief update about the 2017 getaway. It's Memorial Day weekend, which is historically the start of the summer holidays here in the United States. After a rather mild winter in the Northeast and then a very long, cool spring, summer heat has just begun this week with temperatures in the high 80s and low 90s, a lot of humidity. And I think people just feel like this overwhelming urge to get summer started. So they've all decided to come to the Poconos for the weekend. Traffic is crazy and people have lost their minds. It's impossible to make a left-hand turn unassisted by a light. There are fender benders and forest fires. I'm not sure what's going on. Samuel had an event yesterday and we really don't have a lot of plans for the rest of the weekend. So I would like to spend it as quietly as possible. Traffic in the Poconos on holiday weekends is historically horrific. So it's best to stay put as much as possible. And now with a bridge out, our little road is so nice and peaceful and quiet. I just plan on spending as much time at home as possible. Of course, that will involve some cooking on our Big Green Egg charcoal grill. I bought some baby back ribs to try a few new recipes with those. I still have some rhubarb compote for a pizza that we can try doing on the grill. I will definitely make another rhubarb custard pie. I'm disappointed that I did not do any sort of infusion with rhubarb to make a kind of a schnapps or flavored vodka. It sort of slipped my mind, and I think it's the kind of thing that needs to sit for a while. So I didn't do that, but I look forward to a weekend of cooking and experimenting. And I'd also like to thank everyone who chimed in with suggestions for ingredients for our hashtag Power Pantry for the summer months. In June, we will have coconut as the featured ingredient for hashtag Power Pantry. Coconut products seem to be more prevalent than ever, with something new showing up in the supermarket nearly every week. Coconuts are available year-round because they grow in the tropics, so they're harvested year-round. The peak harvesting season is usually October through December. But for this cook-along, anything from fresh coconut, dried coconut, coconut cream, coconut milk, coconut water, any of those things will be great things to try for the month of June. Also, cooking with coconut oil and maybe using it to replace other fats in a recipe, that could be something to try. I'm really looking forward to everyone's suggestions. I like putting coconut flakes into a lot of things, and I buy dried, unsweetened coconut flakes at my health food store. I put them into savory and sweet dishes. Other than that, though, I don't have a lot of experience cooking with coconut. So this will be a great month of experimentation for me. In July, we will have Farmers Market Bounty as the focus ingredient or wide array of ingredients. And August will be a wild card month. So if you would like to continue cooking with farmers market ingredients, if there's something you've been wanting to try, or maybe if you are gardening and you have an explosion of tomatoes or cucumbers or zucchini, maybe you would like to focus on one very plentiful produce item for the month of August. Hopefully that will give us all a lot of options and a lot of topics of discussion over our summer months. So forth. This week I have been focused on completing the Kiyomi dress for a school event that occurred on Tuesday. And I was successful in completing the dress. I began on Saturday by cutting out the pattern pieces and then doing quite a bit of swatching. I decided on silk thread, and probably the most difficult aspect of making this dress was the bias tape. The pattern called for making your own bias tape out of the fabric, which was very slippery. And because of the silk content, I didn't want to use too hot an iron because I didn't want to scorch the fabric. But in order to make bias tape that really works and holds its fold, you need to use a pretty hot iron. Otherwise, the creases don't remain in the fabric so that you can manipulate it. I did find via a trial and error method that it was okay to use steam on this fabric. And using steam did help to set the folds and set seams before I sewed them. Another challenge is that pins I put into the fabric slipped out very easily, so that I would pin something into place, and then by the time I got it to the needle of my sewing machine, some of the pins had popped out or slid out, and then I had to replace them. One thing that can be very difficult with bias tape is to keep it from buckling or puckering along a very tightly curved edge, like a neckline or an armhole. In the case of the Kiyomi dress, I was aware that this puckering was a possibility because I saw in the photographs of the dress in Lotta Jan's Daughter's Everyday Style that the linen version of the dress had some severe puckering in the bias tape along the neckline. So severe that I really thought a stylist should have caught that, or a photographer would not have taken photographs of that portion of the neckline on the dress. Because if it's severe enough for me to notice it in a fashion shot, then it must be pretty severe. I was aware of this and tried to do everything possible to smooth out the fabric and to pin it in place in a way that would avoid buckling or puckering. For the most part, I was successful in that. There is just a little bit of puckering near one of the armhole seams. The dress, as I mentioned in the previous episode, is extremely simple. It's just four pieces: bias tape, a front and back of dress, and then a piece that's folded and sewn to make a little belt. If it weren't for the difficulty of working with this fabric, I think this dress would be pretty easy to make. And so I am in the process of deciding on some double gauze for another version of the dress. The dress is huge. It looks like a tent when you sew it. And so the fit and the look of the silhouette depend upon some fabric with extreme drape so that it fits close to your body when it's belted. There's a version in linen that is unbelted in the photographs in the book. I don't think that version is as attractive as the belted version, but it might be more appealing for some folks, or maybe it's more appealing at a different length. I'm not sure. There's a very long maxi length sundress version that I think is nice, but if I were wearing a sundress, I think I would want slits on the sides. And I think I would want a little bit larger of a neck opening. The neck opening of this dress is very demure, and the shoulder fabric goes right out to the edges of the shoulders, so the armhole openings are very small. I think this is great for a more formal occasion because it gives you great coverage. You can wear a really comfortable, highly structured bra underneath this garment, and the bra straps will not slip or show. That's something that's very challenging with skimpier kinds of summer dresses because you want to wear a structured undergarment and then it's just slipping and showing all the time. So I think that this dress hits a real sweet spot for certain occasions and applications, but it might not be appropriate for others. I would like to try it in a double gauze version and see how that works up and if the fabric is a little bit easier to work with. And I was very pleased with the way this dress came out. I think it's versatile. It is certainly a wardrobe staple. It's in black. It can be dressed up or down. It can be worn with all sorts of shoes and jewelry options. And I think that I will definitely be getting a lot of use out of this dress. Off the shelf. On June 1st, the Eat Your Words read along begins and it continues through the summer months. Yarns at Yinhu listeners are invited to select a work, or maybe more than one, work of food memoir, food journalism, or food-related fiction, and read along and chat about what they find on the thread in Ravelry. There will be a chance to win prizes and a new prize for each month, and all you need to do to enter to win the prize is just participate in the thread. The more participation, the more of a chance you have to win a prize. I've already been so grateful to receive two offers of prizes for the thread. The first, June's prize, will be a skein of sport weight superwash wool dyed by Carol of Foster Sheep Farm. And this is U.S. superwash, the colorway I'm calling creamsicle. It's beautiful, vibrant orange, as well as undyed portions, and I think it would be a lot of fun to knit up during the summer months. Joanna Spring of Knit Spin Farm Podcast, has offered up a collection of her note cards of her very charismatic farm animals, I think chickens, sheep, goats. She has made note cards from her beautiful photography, and they will be going out to a July winner. And I am still interested in a prize for the August drawing. So send me a personal message if you would like to contribute a prize for August. To kick off our Eat Your Words read along, I thought I would pull some selections from my shelf in this genre and do a little bit of reading of an introduction or a passage and try to whet your appetite for this sort of thing and get everyone started. I realized as I was searching my bookshelves that I've given many books of this sort away because I think they're the kind of thing a lot of other people will enjoy. But I did still have a healthy selection on my shelf, so I'll be sharing some of this with you. The first selection is from MFK Fisher's An Alphabet for Gourmands. This book is set up like a dictionary, and she addresses a different topic for each letter. This is from H is for Happy. H is for happy and for what kind of dinner is most often just that evanescent, unpredictable, and purely heaven-sent thing. In general, I think human beings are happiest at table when they are very young, very much in love, or very alone. It is rare to be happy in a group. A man can be merry, gay, keenly excited, but not happy in the sense of being free, free from life's cluttering and clutching. When I was a child, my Aunt Gwen, who was not an aunt at all, but a large-boned and enormous-hearted woman who, thank God, lived next door to us, used to walk my little sister Anne and me up into the hills at sundown. She insisted on pockets. We had to have at least two apiece when we were with her. In one of them, on these twilight promenades, would be some cookies. In the other, oh, deep, sensuous delight would be a fried egg sandwich. Nobody but Aunt Gwen ever made fried egg sandwiches for us. Grandmother was carefully protected from the fact that we had ever heard of them, and as for Mother, preoccupied with a second set of children, she shuddered at the thought of such grease-bound proteins with a thoroughness which should have made us chary, but instead succeeded only in satisfying our human need for secrets. The three of us, Aunt Gwen weighing a good four times what Anne and I did put together, would sneak out of the family ken whenever we could, into the bluing air, our pockets sagging and our spirits spiraling in a kind of intoxication of freedom, breathlessness, fatigue, and delicious anticipation. We would climb high above other mortals onto a far rock or a fallen eucalyptus tree and sit there, sometimes as close as burrs and sometimes apart, singing straight through Pinafore in the Episcopal hymn book and biting voluptuously into our tough, soggy, indigestible, and luscious suppers. We flourished on them, both physically and in our tenacious spirits. This next is from Aphrodite, A Memoir of the Senses by Isabel Allende. I know I have read in the past a portion of this book and talked about her recipe for rice pudding, which appears at the end. This is essentially a cookbook, but with very long introductions to the chapters. And these are some of Isabel Allende's sentiments from the introduction. To justify yet one more collection of recipes or erotic instructions is not easy. Every year, thousands are published, and frankly, I don't know who buys them, because I don't know anyone who cooks or makes love from a manual. People who work hard to earn a living and who pray in secret like you and me improvise in casseroles and bedroom romps as best we can, using what we have at hand without brooding over it or making too much fuss, grateful for our remaining teeth and our enormous good fortune in having someone to embrace. All right, then, so why this book? Because the idea of poking about a bit in aphrodisiacs seems amusing to me, and I hope it will be to you as well. In these pages, I intend to approximate the truth, but that will not always be possible. What, for example, can one say about parsley? Some things scream for a little creativity. How to define an aphrodisiac? Let's say it is any substance or activity that piques amorous desire. Some have a scientific basis, but most are activated by the imagination. Cultures and individuals react to them in their own way. For thousands of years, humanity has experimented with countless possibilities in an incessant search for new stimuli, a search that led to pornography and the genesis of erotic art ancient as the dawn of millenary cave paintings. The difference between the two is a question of taste. What is erotic for one may be pornographic for another. For the Victorians, evil was everywhere. They covered the legs of their tables to preclude bad thoughts, and a young lady was not allowed to hang a man's portrait on the walls of her room for fear that the painting might look on as she was undressing. It didn't take much to excite those good folks. Some aphrodisiacs function through analogy, like the vulva-shaped oyster or phallic asparagus. Others by association, because they remind us of something erotic. They also work through suggestion, because we believe that when we eat the vital organ of another animal, and in some cases, that of another human, as happens among cannibals, we absorb their strength. In general, anything with a French name seems aphrodisiac. In these pages, I intend to offer, to the extent of my knowledge, a description of the most common aphrodisiacs. I hope you have them in your kitchen and that they add to your life the touches of flavor and good humor so badly needed in the whirlwind of modern life. We go racing through our days as if to see who can be the first to die. All that's left to be said is that if you are lucky and these tonics give you the desired result, you will live and die happy, perhaps of a sudden attack caused by a combination of gluttony and lust, the only capital sins that encompass the possibility of style. The others are pure evil and ruin. This passage is from A History of Cooks and Cooking by Michael Simons. Cookery is at once sufficiently familiar to every housekeeper and its luxurious refinements too copiously detailed with manuals and directories to require enlargement, were it even a topic that at all deserved consideration in a work of this nature. This is the way cookery was dismissed in 1823 by the editors of the 6th edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. Cooks have always been in the background, both ever-present and unnoticed. Their contributions have seemed too common, pervasive, trivial, unproblematic. Cooks generally have been women, and their achievements overlooked as inglorious and private. They have been restricted to the chopping board and spice rack. But while each of the cook's actions might be infinitesimal, the results have multiplied into civilization. Only the vulgar would see no more to a kitchen than saucepans and no more to dinner than dishes. Once made the object of serious study or profound thought, the gastronomic arts expand to embrace all three realms of nature and the four corners of the globe, all moral considerations and all social relationships. Virtually every archaeological dig, every diary, every streetscape tells the cook's tale. We do not lack evidence and can appropriate much scholarship, but no one has tried to pull all this together. Since the 19th century, we have become so hyper-specialized that we scarcely know any longer how to place cooks within the great scheme of things. As evidence of consequent conceptual sloppiness, we slip unthinkingly from cooking as heating food, the dictionary meaning, to something much, much more. Unmindful of culinary history, let alone basic physics, we blur the distinction between roasting and baking. English even lacks a collective noun for the heat source: cooking fire, brazier, stove, oven, and so forth. If we are what we eat, cooks have not just made our meals, but they have also made us. They have shaped our social networks, our technologies, arts, and religions. Cooks deserve to have their story told often and well. We need to invent ways to think about them and to revise our views about ourselves in their light. Having to traverse the entire globe and its peoples since the first cook picked up her stone knife, A book truly commensurate with the place of cooks in history would be massive. I offer an introductory essay, a faint sketch of awesome consequences. I really enjoy picking up Michael Pollan's Food Rules, and I was given as a gift this beautiful version illustrated by Mara Kalman. So I'm going to read some of Michael Pollan's introduction, and then I'm going to read a little essay from the illustrator of the book. The 83 rules here are each accompanied by a paragraph or two of explanation, except for a handful that are self-explanatory. There is no need to learn or memorize them all because many will take you to the same place. For example, rule number 11, avoid foods that you see advertised on television. And rule number 7, avoid food products containing ingredients that a third grader cannot pronounce. These are both designed to keep more or less the same highly processed food-like products out of your cart. My hope is that a handful of these rules will prove sufficiently sticky or memorable that they will become second nature to you, something you do or don't do without giving it a thought. While I call them rules, I think of them less as hard and fast laws than as personal policies. Policies are useful tools. Instead of prescribing highly specific behaviors, they supply us with broad guidelines that should make everyday decision-making easier and swifter. Armed with a general policy, such as rule number 39, don't eat breakfast cereals that change the color of the milk, you'll find you won't have to waste as much time reading ingredient labels and making decisions standing in the cereal aisle. Think of these food policies as little algorithms designed to simplify your eating life. Adopt whichever ones stick and work best for you. And then from the illustrator, Mara Kalman. When Michael asked if I would like to illustrate this book, I said two things. First, yes, absolutely yes. Second, that cheese doodles had a beloved place in our family history. He did not hold that against me. This is a great country, vast, complicated, with plenty of room for extremes. Everyone eats food. That is the universal connector. Life is fragile, fleeting. What do we want? To be healthy, to celebrate, and to love and live life to the fullest. So here comes Michael Pollan with this little monumental book, a humanistic and smart book that describes a sane and happy world of eating. It asks us gently to hit the reset button on manufactured food and go back in time. I like going back in time. It gives me more time to walk around and savor the world and the food in it. At Monticello, I walked around Thomas Jefferson's garden. He was crazy about peas. Here is a painting of his vegetable tureen full of peas. Peas, peas, we should all eat peas. Not at every meal, of course. May we all eat well and flourish. Mara Kalman. And finally, here is a selection from the book I have chosen to read for the Eat Your Words read-along. It's titled Coming Home to Eat by Gary Paul Nevan. And the subtitle is The Pleasures and Politics of Local Foods. This is from the preface and acknowledgments to the book. This book is about a year of eating locally, a year that also happened to be a watershed in the history of global food politics. It is the story of finding kindred, food-loving souls within a 250-mile radius of my home in Arizona and sharing with them the pleasures of gardening and gathering, pit roasting and fermenting, feasting and frolicking. But it is also a book of juxtapositions about how the remaining farmers, fishermen, and foragers within my food shed struggle with the challenges, insults, and absurdities different from the ones their ancestors faced a century ago. Whenever I foraged with my neighbors for wild greens, hunted for quail, or sowed heirloom crops, we have seldom been out of earshot of the global vending machine. It can still be heard dropping its hermetically sealed packages of textured soy protein, genetically engineered tortillas, and artificial spices, no matter how hard you or I try to get away from its noise. Fortunately, I am not the only one wondering what kinds of ancient culinary melodies are being drowned out by the noise of that transnational vending machine. One defining moment, the equivalent of a Boston Tea Party, can fittingly be said to have taken place at the turn of the 21st century. Farmers refused to grow certain patented seeds foisted upon them by transnational corporations, and students destroyed experimental fields and labs where genetically engineered crops were being developed. Consumers demanded the contents of foods be labeled on their packages and boycotted companies whose advertising was deceptive. Mobs attacked McDonald's and Starbucks as part of the protests against the annual meeting of the World Trade Organization in Seattle. Groups in other countries fought against the corporate control of farmlands, seeds, and genes, and banned U.S. agricultural products potentially harmful to butterflies and babies. The launching of the slow food movement in the United States made me aware that there are at least 100,000 like-minded souls in Europe and Latin America. This book celebrates the sensual pleasures of food without ignoring its global politics, for we will hardly be able to savor such pleasures any longer if we do not decide how to disconnect that omnipresent vending machine. Whether you're interested in the deeply personal, the political, or the purely frivolous, I think this Eat Your Words summer read-along has a book possibility for you. Yarns at Yinhu listeners have submitted titles so that I've been able to collect an extensive book list. All the titles and authors are contained on a page on the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. I will link to it in the show notes. And there are three categories: food memoir, food journalism, and food-related fiction. If you know of a work that isn't contained on that list, certainly you can suggest it. And when I see your post, I will add it to the list. I wish everyone a great summer of reading along and posting in the thread. And here's just a bit of information about the 2017 getaway, because I have had so many inquiries recently. The 2017 getaway will be known as the Knit Local Getaway. It will be held on April 29th and 30th in Washington County, New York. It will be concurrent with the Washington County Farm and Fiber Tour. The location for the getaway will be St. Mary's Lodge. It's on the campus of the Christ the King Spiritual Life Center in Greenwich, New York. Accommodations are spare and simple, but we have a lot of fun at the getaway. Because of the overwhelming interest in this year's getaway, I will be organizing a lottery. Lottery entry will begin on January 1st, and it will close on January 30th, 2017. The lottery is not a first-come, first-serve type of lottery. It's simply an opportunity to express your interest in attending. First, I will invite all folks who have attended the 2016 getaway and want to attend again. So if you've attended in the past, those participants will be given priority. All remaining openings will be drawn in a lottery system, and then those folks will be informed that they were selected. Everyone else will be put on a waiting list. And then there will be a small registration fee to hold your spot. I think this system will allow me to honor the friendships that have been formed at our first getaway and offer spaces to additional participants. You can find more information about this getaway, as well as a link to the lottery entry form, on my website, yarns@yinhu.com. There's a page devoted to the getaway with photographs and pricing information and a link to the lottery. Like I said, the lottery doesn't open until January 1st and it closes on January 30th. So you have a whole month to think about whether or not you would like to participate in this event and then enter the lottery if you are interested. If you have any other questions that were not answered in this segment, please send me a personal message on Ravelry and I will be happy to give you more information.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. The music for the episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a